Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. The Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Today the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be heard, they are Patsy Keene versus Diana Weaver from Dallas County and the 10th Appellate District. Progressive Mutual Insurance Company County, Progressive County Mutual Insurance Company versus Paul Singh from Harris County and the 6th Appellate District. In the interest of AV and JV from McLennan County and the 10th Appellate District. And Hanna Oil and Gas Corporation and Robert Rowling versus Tom and David McCall, Travis County, and the 3rd Appellate District. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We are recording these arguments, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and complete the arguments before a somewhat late lunch. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Keene versus Weaver.
May it please the court, Mr. Maurice, President Jr., and Miss Elizabeth Thompson, and Mr. Paul Piazza to present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Maurice, President Jr., and Miss Elizabeth Hopkins will open for the first 16 minutes. Mr. Pascal Paul Piazza will present the rebuttal.
May I please report. My name is Maurice Bressingham. I have the privilege of representing Patsy Keene. I've been in mining client for more than 20 years. This case presents, of course, a complex question dealing with federal law, intersection of federal law and state law, and the question of ERISA and preemption. Factually, what is this case about? We believe it is about the right, the guaranteed right of Mr. Weaver, who is now deceased, to designate a beneficiary to annuity contracts that are both conceded and controlled in their entirety by ERISA. Two plans, one by TIA and one by CREF, are pension plans and thus are subject to the anti-alienation provisions of ERISA. Legally, we believe that this court must recognize that there is no gap, gore, or void in ERISA that would permit the creation of any type of common law or allow any type of common law rule to have any effect on
the If I understand the Secretary of Labor's brief, the Secretary of Labor takes the position that Egelhoff does not control the disposition of this case. Is that your position as well?
No.
So what is your position with respect to Egelhoff?
My position in Egelhoff is that Egelhoff does control the disposition of this case because of the rules that are established in Egelhoff for analyzing when preemption attaches. I think it is clear beyond any question, and this court recognized that clarity in the Barnett decision.
Leaving us with Egelhoff, the Court of Appeals here did indicate that the redesignation statute in Texas was preempted, and that's not, as I understand it, the basis for the respondent's claims at this point in time.
The respondent's claims is redesignation? As I understand it now, there is a claim that it is based on a waiver theory.
Exactly. And Egelhoff did not specifically address that issue.
If you want to say it is the word waiver used and we say that, I would have to agree with you. That is exactly correct. But that is far, with all respect, too simplistic, I believe, in the analysis of Egelhoff, Barnett, Boggs, and the others. You simply cannot ignore the analytical matrix that is established in those cases.
You would agree, though, that there is a body of law out of the circuits that acknowledges waiver as an issue in the case, and that the Supreme Court of the United States denied cert in one of those cases 5 days after it decided Egelhoff.
I have some familiarity with that case.
Is that a correct reading of where the cases stand?
I believe that is a correct listing of what exists right now.
But I understand. I'm just trying to then understand the relationship between the multiple decisions out of the federal circuits that apparently the Supreme Court decided not to deal with at the same time it decided Egelhoff. So where do we stand vis-a-vis that body of case law and Egelhoff?
I believe that body of case law really has no utility whatsoever in the analysis of this particular case. Let's talk about, for a moment, the case you talked about, the one that was denied cert 5 days after Egelhoff, that is the Hayes-Manning case, which I was the attorney on that particular case at all particular levels. Hayes-Manning is, of course, cited in Egelhoff, but I think it is cited for a very limited purpose, that is, to establish that there is a problem here that we are going to try to resolve. And I think that has no more utility than that. As a matter of fact, I believe that what we saw in the Hayes-Manning case was simply a situation where the Supreme Court of the United States, much like this court does from time to time, agreed with the result, but simply did not adopt the reasoning whatsoever. In fact, if you take a look at the footnotes, there is no indication that the Supreme Court recognized or agreed with that reasoning.
Did Manning involve pension benefits?
No, it retired. It was a welfare benefit case, Your Honor. It was an insurance policy, if you will, that accrued as part of the employment of the deceased. It is a welfare benefit plan.
Do you think that makes a difference?
Ultimately, no. I do not think it makes a difference because I don't think we have to reach the anti-alienation question at all in this case. In this particular case, I think we are talking about a classic analysis of preemption with a well-established framework at this point in time that says that the attempt to create some type of common law to deal with a perceived problem simply doesn't exist. You can't do that anymore.
Let me ask you about this problem. I didn't understand the cases that I was reading to be talking about a problem or even a gap. What I understood the cases to be saying is what happens if the beneficiary doesn't want the benefits? What happens if the beneficiary says that I don't want to accept these benefits? Don't they have the right to do that? And you talk about alienation, but I guess one of the issues was we have this whole body of law where parties give up the right to receive something in exchange for something else. And it seemed to me these cases all went to, can a beneficiary waive their rights to a benefit under ERISA? And they all seemed to say, certainly. Now, how do I
deal with that?
Yeah, how do you deal with that? They have to take it? You have to cash this check? You have to take it? Or how do you deal with that?
In this particular case, you did not have any waiver whatsoever in the divorce decree. All you had was a petitioning of property. You had Mr. Weaver receiving this body of property over here. You had Mrs. Weaver, now Mrs. Keene, receiving this body of property over here. Mr. Weaver waived nothing. He still had the unfettered right guaranteed by ERISA to do with that property as he saw fit. And that is what has happened here.
Are you taking the position that this is what he intended to have happen, or does the record reflect that he intended, or was this an oversight on his part that he never changed the beneficiary?
Do we know? The man is deceased, so we can
understood,
never know.
Understood, but you're not here telling the court that he intended to leave that beneficiary designation as it was, and intended for his ex-wife to have those benefits despite the fact that the property had been petitioned otherwise.
I can make a better argument for that.
No, sir, I just want to understand. I don't want an argument. I was trying to understand factually where
factually, then I'll address that square up factually. For 13 years after the divorce occurred, he allowed that beneficiary designation to remain.
Well, I understand, but you keep saying that he intended this to be the beneficiary. And my question to you is there any evidence that that's what he intended, or could this have been an oversight on his part that he never got around to changing the beneficiary?
Objectively, we have his paper, we have what he put on paper. Objectively, we have him receiving, over a period of 13 years, notices from TIA and PREF of the existence of the plan, of the fact that this is covered by ERISA, of the changes in the REA. We have all of those objective manifestations.
We also have the objective manifestation that he had a new wife and 3 children.
That came along some time after
Going back to Justice Enoch's question in terms of looking at your client's position in terms of being the beneficiary that was designated, she did sign documents that indicated that she was giving up her right to claim those benefits by acknowledging the partition that gave him sole ownership.
She gave up any right to compel him to do anything as far as those benefits were concerned. That's correct.
Well, she gave up any ownership interest she may have had in them because he became the sole owner of them.
That's exactly right. That's just between you and me. I can make you the beneficiary of an insurance policy even though you have no insurance or no right.
Well, I understand, but that's not what happened here. She gave up her right to claim any ownership interest. And now she's claiming an ownership interest.
As a result of his objective acts, yes.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I think I've used my 7
yes,
minutes.
That's fine.
Thank you, sir.
That's fine. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Hopkins, and I'm here on behalf of the Secretary of Labor, United States Department of Labor, as amicus curiae in this case in support of petitioner.
Can you address the question that I thought was raised, and maybe I'm wrong, that if we conclude that a beneficiary cannot waive their interest in these pension plans, it has tax consequences, it interferes with the beneficiary's ability to affect their tax consequences here?
We don't disagree that at the time of receiving benefits, a beneficiary can decline to take those benefits, and that's what that IRS ruling, revenue ruling, is about.
But
and
before the benefit comes in, you argue they could not waive those benefits.
That's correct, and we think that this is exactly what the anti-alienation provision is directed at. And that's why in cases, where there's, for instance, a garnishment under court order or a settlement amounting to a garnishment under court order, that can't be enforced to defeat a participant's or beneficiary's interest in a pension plan. It doesn't apply in the context of a welfare plan, for instance, an insurance policy. So we would say that those cases are somewhat different. Part of our argument goes, is applicable whether it's an insurance plan.
It makes a difference on whether it's a benefits plan or a welfare plan.
It's
because of the alienation provisions. If it's a benefit plan, you can't alienate your interest. If it is an insurance policy, you can. If you're a beneficiary.
If it's a pension plan, you can't alienate your interest. That is correct. And the Supreme Court in the Boggs v. Boggs case in 1997. Specifically held that the anti-alienation or spendthrift provision is applicable to a beneficiary's benefits under an ERISA pension plan. So that argument that it doesn't apply to a beneficiary's interest is not correct. It was decided long ago, and I believe the cases that the respondent cites to that effect predate the Boggs decision in 1997, but that clearly is not the case.
Did I understand your brief correctly that you believe that this question that's presented in this case has not been answered by the Supreme Court yet?
Technically, it was not answered. I agree with that. In Egelhoff, Egelhoff was about preemption, and certainly the court below in this case, said that the state redesignation law was preempted under Egelhoff, and that is correct. I would say, though, that the issue was raised in Egelhoff. The Secretary of Labor briefed the issue of waiver. Factually, Egelhoff is pretty much indistinguishable in that case. The contingent beneficiaries claimed that under a divorce decree, the designated beneficiary waived her benefits, and
they didn't address the issue.
The Supreme Court did not. The Supreme Court reversed and remanded. The Washington Supreme Court, however, where the case originated, had that issue briefed to them and dismissed the case anyway on the basis of Egelhoff. So it's true, I agree that Egelhoff did not directly address this issue. I would say, though, that the reasoning of the court that ERISA's explicit provisions defining a beneficiary to be the person designated by the plan participant, the provision that says the plan administrator is to follow and has to follow the written plan documents, and the provision that requires that a plan provide that a pension benefits cannot be assigned or alienated. All three of those provisions conflict with the idea that you can create a federal
plan. Can I follow up on Judge Enoch's question? I mean, did I understand you correctly that under, as you paint the interpretation of the statute, if I'm a beneficiary, I have to take the benefits? and there's no tax consequences to me when I take them and then give them to someone else, even though they pass through my ownership at some point?
No. At the time that the benefits are being offered, you have the right not to refuse them. And then the IRS has ruled, and we don't disagree with this ruling, that the tax consequences do not fall on you of taking those benefits.
But you said that I can't, as a beneficiary, I can't refuse to take them. You said once I get them, then I can certainly waive, I can do something with them, but you've indicated that I can't refuse to take them.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I misspoke. You can refuse at the time that they're being offered.
But that's what I mean.
You can't waive ahead of time through another proceeding. And the reason for this is that in both Boggs and Egelhoff, the Supreme Court said one of the great goals here of ERISA is to make sure that plan administrators can ascertain who the participant is, who the beneficiary is, and can pay benefits
promptly. But they have to review quadros all the time to be able to determine that. I mean, there are factual determinations that have to be made by plan administrators in determining who to pay.
It isn't
that clean in the real world.
Well, that's correct, although the way that quadros are intended to work, at the time that that someone gets a domestic relations order, They're supposed to file it with the plan administrator, who then gives notice, determines whether it meets the qualifications for a qualified domestic relations order. Basically, does it make it clear who's to get the benefits? Are they the same type of benefits? Does it give the names and addresses? Are there certain technical requirements? And then qualifies it so that when it comes time to pay the benefits, benefits can be paid promptly.
Let me ask you a question. One of the other issues that was raised is there's nothing apparently in the statute that indicates how you designate beneficiaries. There doesn't seem to be a particular form that you're required to file or something. At least that's one of the arguments. Do you agree?
The statute says that the beneficiary is the person designated by the plan participant or as provided in the plan. So the plan can certainly control what the documents
are. We have this document where the respective rights of the parties are spelled out with particularity to this plan. Could I have just sent that document to the plan administrator before he died, and would that have been a designation of the beneficiary? I get it. She doesn't. Does that satisfy the designation?
Well, in the first instance, that's a question for the plan administrator. And this is one of the problems, actually, in this case, in many cases of this kind. This case was actually brought not as a claim for benefits under ERISA, as it should have been, but as a breach of contract claim. And that the way that this is supposed to work is that the question is supposed to go to the plan administrator, and then the court is, you know, assuming that there's discretion involved, is supposed to defer to the plan administrator on review, and that didn't happen in this case. And that's really, this case is sort of exemplary of the problems that are raised, both in terms of delay, in terms of defeating the whole structure and the way that this is supposed to work.
Does the Secretary of Labor think that that the result is somewhat perverse, that a beneficiary can in fact have given up all ownership or right to claim in the benefits and yet turn around at a period of time later and act inconsistent with that?
Well, there,
I mean, does the Secretary not see any problem or, you know, perverse?
Well, actually, under the facts of this case, the participant at any time could have divested her of those interests by filing.
I understand that, but I'm not focusing on him at this point in time. I'm talking about her.
Well, you know, I think in any particular case, you can speculate. I don't know the facts of this case really, and I'm not sure anybody knows what the intents of the parties were at this point. But you know, there can be injustices with any rule. This rule draws a bright line, and I'm sure there are cases that come close to either side of the line where there is an injustice. But any rule is going to amount to injustices.
Let me clarify. Had this document been sent to the plan administrator, the plan administrator would have the obligation to determine whether or not this document is a redesignation.
That's correct. I think he probably. I'm not sure he could have, because this didn't.
There's no magic to this designation. So he'd just be deciding, is this a designation or isn't it a designation?
Right. It certainly was not a quadro. I mean, it did not.
Well, this predated the time when quadros were.
Yeah.
part of the statute.
I mean, I understand there's an argument about what a quadro is. Maybe that's to limit the discretion. But your position would be, had this gone up there, I think you may be correct, as I understand it, that there's no magic to the designation. There just has to be clear. And it goes to the, can that designation, I write out a designation, I'm redesignating my beneficiary, and I put it in the mail, and I die that day, and the designation is received by the plan administrator 3 days later, I'm already dead. Does the plan administrator,
It depends on what the plan terms say. Actually, the plan here said that, as long as the plan administrator got it, it could date back to the time that it was signed. Some plans are very express and very explicit about what's required, and it's our position that ERISA provides that the written plan documents control and provides for written designations for the clarity and convenience that it provides essentially to plans, which is ultimately a cost-saving feature for plans and for their participants and beneficiaries.
Any other questions?
I have some.
Okay.
Thank you. Going back to Egelhoff, it was my recollection that before the case got to the U.S. Supreme Court that the federal common law issues had been briefed in the Washington State Courts. Is that your recollection as well?
That's correct.
Where in your brief you say a couple of times that the Washington Supreme Court dismissed this. Is that a reported action anywhere? How do we find that?
I can't remember now if it's reported. If it's not, I can send you the order of dismissal. We were involved when it was remanded to the Washington Supreme Court, and I'd be happy to send it to the parties.
Following up on Justice Enix's question, let's suppose that this divorce decree and the agreement had been sent to the plan administrator. Would this have been clear enough, in your view, to change the designation of the beneficiary? But under the statute, as I understand it, ERISA says that you can treat a pre-1985 divorce decree as a quadro. Would this meet a quad? Could the plan administrator have said this is a redesignation?
Well, it certainly is not a quadro. A quadro is designed not to divest a spouse or a child or a dependent of an interest, but to allow a spouse or child or dependent who was not designated but who is supposed to receive benefits under a divorce decree to
how would this have been treated? A question. Had this been given to the plan administrator, how should it have been treated?
I think the plan administrator. I wouldn't want to say. I'm not sure what. I think it would be a determination for the plan administrator in the first instance. But it certainly doesn't meet the definition of a quadro. And really, the way that ERISA intends for these things to happen is that the participant can redesignate, and that's why during the amendments, ERISA gave a way for an ex-spouse who's supposed to get benefits to get her domestic relations order in front of the plan administrator and get those benefits, but it didn't, it didn't see a problem with divesting an ex-spouse of the interest because a participant can do that at any time. And there really was not a gap there to fill. There wasn't a question. So I would think now, actually, that, it depends on, if the participant sent a letter saying, I intend to divest, Patsy Keene, my ex-wife, of her benefits, send me any papers if I need to fill out anything else, and they didn't. I mean, that, it depends on the facts. And it's a question, again, for the plan administrator in the first instance, who is entitled to deference as long as it's a question where discretion is involved.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Stephen W. Sloan will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I'd like to take a little bit different tack. That might bring a little bit of light to the issue we have here, which really is the enforceability under ERISA of an assignment of benefits by a beneficiary. There is a provision of ERISA that addresses that sort of question, and that is the anti-alienation provision of ERISA, Section 206D.
Do you agree these are pension plan benefits as opposed to welfare?
Yes, I do, Your Honor, and therefore the anti-alienation of provisions of ERISA apply only to pension benefits, so they conceivably come into play. The important point here, though, is that the anti-alienation provisions do not apply to the interests of a beneficiary, which is what is at issue here. The Supreme Court case that's reasoning is really controlling here is the Mackey v. Lanier Collection Agency case, which is cited in our brief. That case decided a preemption issue, but it examined the question of whether ERISA preempts, actually the Georgia garnishment statute, as applied to employee welfare benefits. And the court's reasoning went something like this.
But my recollection is my distinction. They said you can't touch pension plan benefits. Welfare benefits are different.
What the question is whether the assignment in question or the alienation in question is subject to the anti-alienation provision, rather than whether it's a pension plan or a welfare plan. I think you have to look more closely. In the Mackey decision, the court said, look, Congress, in enacting ERISA, had before it a scheme where employee benefits were alienated, assigned, garnished. That was the reality. Congress decided to mention only pension benefits. In doing so, Congress implicitly said that it's okay to garnish or assign welfare benefits. Therefore, that's okay under ERISA, no preemption. The same reasoning applies here because we don't have, we have a pension plan, but we have a beneficiary's interest, not a participant's interest, so that Ms. Keene's alleged waiver of her right just simply is not subject to the anti-alienation rule. You can see that in a number of respects. We talked about that in our brief. You can look at the statutory language. It talks about the interest with respect to a participant. It's silent as to beneficiaries. In fact, the point Ms. Hopkins made about the quadro provisions, which are an exception to the anti-alienation rule, qualified domestic relations order, do not provide. You cannot have a quadro in a case such as ours, because a quadro is not a quadro if it provides for the participant retaining his own interests, which is what essentially happened here in the divorce decree. Mr. Weed kept his benefits,
what
so there was no alienation, so you
couldn't
have a quadro.
What would happen in a case where a husband and wife were married and she was named as the beneficiary under the pension plan benefits, and husband said, honey, I can't alienate these, but you need to, I've got gambling debts, and I want you to assign these over to somebody for future interest in them. Is that okay?
Well, this is another point I guess I was going to make. With certain exceptions that don't apply here, as Ms. Hoppe said, as Mr. Weaver could have done at any time, he can change the beneficiary designation at any time. There's nothing, pension plan or not. He can say, Ms. Keene, I'm sorry, you're out. I'm going to scrap your name off. I'm not going to tell you about it. I'm not going to ask for your consent. And that's effective.
And so if an anti-alienation provision applies to a beneficiary, you'd have some difficulty in whether or not the participant could redesignate the beneficiary.
It would be absolutely in conflict with the basic statutory scheme, which is that the participant can designate his own beneficiary and can change his beneficiary in time.
Then how do we square the fact that he did not change the beneficiary?
Well, I think, in truth, I think we all know what happened. The divorce decree took care of that. The divorce decree specifically mentioned his TIAA CREF account. I don't know what most people think, but I think most people think that if you have a judgment and you agree with the beneficiary, it's not going to make a claim to those benefits, and you've taken care of it. I think that's what happened.
There's no evidence on this one way or the other.
Well, there is this, Your Honor. Ms. Keene has never claimed in this case at trial, on appeal before this court, that there was anything to the contrary, that there was anything vague or unclear about that divorce decree, that she never got up and testified. I didn't intend to give up those benefits. There's no testimony to that effect. Now, obviously, Mr. Weaver couldn't testify. But I think the paper's clear on its face as to what Ms. Keene intended.
But it's his separate property, so he can do with it as he wishes. He could leave her the beneficiary, he could change it. Why aren't we bound by what he did?
That's the scheme. That's the scheme, Your Honor, with one exception. And I can talk about that if you like, and that's not applicable in this case, but that's where you have a qualified joint survivor annuity. What the law says, the exception to the rule is the beneficiary presumptively is a matter of law as the spouse of the participant. And it's interesting, in that case, that's the one case where Congress said, and by the way, the participant can't unilaterally change who the beneficiary is.
But that doesn't apply here. I'm saying the decree said it's his sole separate property. He can do with it as he wishes.
Right.
So he could have left it to his former wife had he chosen. And that's the way he left it. Why should we go beyond that designation?
Well, because I think what we have here, and I guess that really goes into Egelhoff and whether Egelhoff controls. If Egelhoff means what Ms. Keene, apparently not the Department of Secretary of Labor, but Ms. Keene means, then you never look beyond the beneficiary designation. That's the end of the debate. If under the if the beneficiary designation is Patsy Keene, that's all we have to look at. We never look at anything else.
That's Boggs' interpretation, isn't it?
No, that's not. Boggs.
Don't they really say you look at what the plan administrator has, and that's it?
That's their interpretation of Egelhoff, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor. And that can't be. That just can't be, among other things.
Why do you think the Washington Supreme Court dismissed the federal common law claims in Egelhoff after the Egelhoff decision?
I was not a part of that, Your Honor. I could really step it up.
But you agree that it was briefed in the state courts before it went to the U.S. Supreme Court?
I do not know that. The reason I was saying that Egelhoff can't mean what Ms. Keene says it and says it does and the Secretary suggested it does, point number one, it would render the anti-alienation provision of ERISA near surplusage. It would be there for no reason at all. If the only reason, if all you had to look to is a beneficiary designation or a participant, there would be no reason to have an anti-alienation rule because you couldn't, by definition, alienate any benefits. That would mean also that the court's decision in Matthew, which I just talked to you about, was overruled by Egelhoff because it held, as the Department of Labor conceived, that garnishment of employee welfare benefits was okay.
But it also held that you can't garnish pension plan benefits.
Well, Egelhoff, Your Honor's reasoning, if it is based on the sections of the risk they're talking about, cannot be limited to pension benefits.
That one of those cases squarely said that. They drew a distinction between garnishing pension plan benefits and garnishing welfare benefits.
Yes, there is that distinction.
You cannot garnish pension.
Yes, the Guidry decision, the Supreme Court decision held that. Yes, certainly.
Well, your position, though.
But it is participants, not a benefit.
Your position is that if Egelhoff had been a little better argued, it would have come out the other way.
No, I think Egelhoff's right.
Well, no, but if the other issue had been addressed, argued, it would come out the other way.
Egelhoff is a question of ERISA preemption. It is not.
It is not addressed by the rule under ERISA.
You
agree that 9.302 is preempted?
Yes.
But it's going to apply anyway. Why wouldn't that have been the case in Egelhoff?
Technically, state law may coincide with what the federal rule of decision
has
is.
Has it ever not? Well, we've got six or eight cases, and they all follow state law. The ones that do, that's where you might look.
I think that the easier analysis is to say, look, under Maggie, Supreme Court said Congress addressed the issue of assignments. We say Congress said if a assignment does not run contrary to ERISA's anti-alienation rule, it's okay under ERISA.
But we're not talking about assignment here. There's no question that the court could, quote, assign these rights solely to the husband. Now the question is, the husband left a designation. What do we do that with that designation?
I guess my point again, Your Honor, if you stopped the designation, you wouldn't need to look at the anti-alienation rule. If the designation always controlled, you couldn't garnish employee welfare benefits. You couldn't assign any sort of benefit at all. And that's not the rule. The rule is that some assignments, some waivers, some alienation, some garnishments
are
okay.
Who did the beneficiary assign these benefits to?
Well, she assigned them or waived them, however you want to use the term, to her husband.
And then he kept her as a designation, so doesn't it bounce back to her? I mean, it seems more circular. Do you keep talking about assignment?
Well, the designation and assignment of an assignment, I believe, Your Honor, or a waiver presupposes that a person has some right to benefits under the plan or some claim to benefits under the plan. That would be either by virtue of being a participant or being a designated beneficiary. An assignment would be, or a garnishment would be, after the fact.
Back to Justice Heck's question about Egelhoff. There was briefing in that case on the federal common law, and the argument was made that even if the statute was preempted, that common law should give the benefits to the second wife. And if that were the case, why didn't Egelhoff come out the other way?
Well, Your Honor, I think if Egelhoff addressed that issue, the court wouldn't have denied certain Manning v. Hayes, which held precisely the contrary. It went along the lines of the majority of the courts of appeals, which held that knowing involuntary waivers of benefits are in fact enforceable. So I guess I can't answer your question again.
Is it possible under this? in this case, you have the expression in the decree by Ms. Keene that she gives up her interest in this pension plan. Now, that is there any problem? I mean, in the preemption, where a state can't do that automatically by statute, require this under Egelhoff, is there anything in Egelhoff that prohibits Ms. Keene from agreeing to do that?
Nothing whatsoever.
So her agreement could coincide with the state law, but if it does, do you have some authority that says that if the state law is preempted, then her agreement isn't binding, or she can't make that agreement under
state law?
No, under federal preemption, under the ERISA.
Federal preemption is a different question. I think the federal rule of decision in most cases, if I'm understanding your question, is that yes, in fact, that knowing voluntary waiver of benefits is entirely consistent with ERISA and enforceable. And that's probably consistent with most state laws, which have probably guided to experiments.
If we wind up having to look at decrees and interpret those rather than look at express designations or redesignations, isn't it going to put the courts in an intolerable position?
Well, they already have to do that, as Justice Anderson, I think, pointed out. They also have to look at any divorce decree to see whether it qualifies for a quadro. In fact, even before 1984, by the way, it's a bit disingenuous, I think, for anybody to say that there's something wrong with the divorce decree because it doesn't meet the qualifications of quadro, because those are requirements that didn't exist. And this legislation itself says that pre-1985 divorce decrees can be considered enforceable because before that time the courts weren't even sure if they were preempted or not. And that wasn't clear until 1985, but arguably they were not.
Well, even today we're having to guess at what his intent was, and it's not clear. You want us to infer that, but it could certainly be the other way. We just don't know.
I respectfully disagree. Having read the divorce decree, I don't think that it could be any clearer, especially given the terms of the decree and Ms. King's lack of testimony on the subject. I just don't think there's a question about what was intended here.
Well, it was virtually identical to the decree in the Lyman Lumber case, and they said that wasn't clear to them at all.
Well, this refers to there's only one TIA correct account, and this specifically refers to that. It doesn't just refer to all pension benefits or all welfare benefits. I don't remember exactly what the Lyman Lumber case was, but this specifically mentions the account. I don't know how much more specific you could be except for copying and attaching it as an exhibit to the order.
Mr. Sloan, you keep saying this is not a preemption case.
Yes,
what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that there's no question in my mind that under Egelhoff, this Texas Family Code doesn't control who the appropriate recipient of the benefits here is.
But it ends up doing that.
Well, it ends up with the same result.
Well, preemption law is pretty strange, but it seems to me very odd that ERISA preempts state law, doesn't supply another rule, says look to the federal common law. Federal common law says, well, we're going to look to the state statute that's just been preempted, and here we are home again.
Well, it is strange.
That's
Your
a
Honor.
Kind of a long way around.
Yeah, the difficulty lies, and I understand what you're saying, that conflict preemption is a typical form of federal preemption used. Federal law grants state law if there's a conflict.
Well,
the risk goes beyond that.
Have there ever been any federal cases, or any cases that look to a federal common law of a gap filler for ERISA and developed that or devised that contrary to what the preempted state law was? In other words, some state that didn't have a statute like this would say, well, 45 other states do, and we need uniformity, so that's going to be the ERISA
common law. Ideally, that's what courts would do. I'm not familiar with any cases actually doing that in the preemption context. I will tell you that courts do manufacture, so to speak, or apply the rules or principles under ERISA where ERISA doesn't expressly dictate the result. For example, when a plan can be, an employee pension plan, for example, could be amended or terminated, that sort of thing. The courts look, for example, to the law of trust. And the Supreme Court specifically told courts to do that because that was sort of the foundation of ERISA itself. So, and that, by the way, in this case also would allow the beneficiary to waive her claim to benefits. That would be the law under the statement of trust. And let me address one point about the revenue ruling as well. It's strange indeed if the anti-assignment rule prohibits a beneficiary from waiving her right to benefits before she actually becomes entitled to it, but allows her to waive it after she actually vests in it. In other words, it becomes her property. Especially since before that time, before the death of the participant, he can write her off the list at any time. So I think that the position in the general counsel memorandum, the revenue ruling, that even after a participant dies so that a beneficiary vests, so it's really her interest and nobody else's, that she's allowed to disclaim that benefit, strongly suggests that, again, I think it reinforces that the anti-alienation rule doesn't apply to beneficiaries' interest. And if you want a narrower holding, I would suggest that it doesn't apply to beneficiaries' interest where they're waiving their interest in favor of the participant whose benefit is to begin with. In very many ways, this is not an assignment case. If you look at the divorce decree, it is simply Frank Weaver as participant retaining his right to benefits. Again, there's no alienation under those circumstances. And the anti-alienation rule really has the underlying purpose of it.
But then you get back to the question. It's his benefits. He can do whatever he wants to with them, and he designated his final wife. He didn't change the designation. So.
Well, there was the intervening fact of the divorce and divorce.
What if he redesignated her after the divorce?
Pardon me?
What if he redesignated her after the divorce?
Well, I don't think we have any question here. I don't think we have the question of whether the beneficiary designation results even absent a waiver. I mean, that's the issue we have before the court. I mean, if he'd redesignated, then we wouldn't have this issue. I think it'd be, there would be no claim by Ms. Keene to the benefits, no colorable claim.
I'm not understanding your answer. If the decedent, following the divorce, had said, no, I really do want you to have them, notwithstanding the divorce decree, where would we be?
I would have a much poorer argument on my part.
But as Judge Jefferson points out, we don't really know one way or the other. And so why should we argue about this, something that we really don't know and can't decide, as opposed to having a bright-line rule?
Well, again, the bright-line rule, is just irreconcilable with other provisions of ERISA. It would write the anti-alienation provision out and make it totally redundant.
I don't follow that, because if he can do with her what he chooses, and he chooses to leave it to his former spouse, how does that write the anti-alienation provisions out of ERISA?
Because there was an arguable alienation or an assignment later on in the divorce decree. There was an alienation or assignment after the divorce, in the divorce decree by Ms. Keene. So we have that additional fact. You have an assignment or an alienation argument.
I don't understand what that has to do with the ERISA. How does that violate the ERISA alienation provisions or write it out of the statute?
Well, the Supreme Court has said that an assignment that does not violate the anti-alienation of provisions of ERISA is enforceable under ERISA, under the Mackey v. Lanier Collection Agency case. Here we have an assignment or a waiver, however you want to look at it, that does not violate the anti-alienation.
But he chooses to give it back to her, let's say. How does that violate the anti-alienation provisions of ERISA?
If he chose to redesignate her as a beneficiary or not.
Or just decides to leave her. He says, well, I'm not going to change it. How does that violate the anti-alienation? How does his subjective mindset have anything to do with the alienation provision of ERISA?
Well, his designation of a beneficiary does not. Short
answer. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Pascal Paul Piazza. I have the opportunity to provide a rebuttal. First of all, Justice Hankinson, this is a preemption case. The 10th Court of Appeals recognized that because the issue in this case is the distribution of benefits under the plan, and all the courts have universally, including this court in Barnett, said that is the sole province of ERISA. This is a preemption case.
Okay. If they had sent this decree to the plan administrator, would the plan administrator have to make a determination whether this was is a redesignation of beneficiaries?
The plan administrator would have to determine under the terms of the plan whether that was a proper redesignation of a beneficiary, yes. And so this is a pre-quadro. I think that one of the important things is, you know, Justice Hankins, you made a comment about, well, doesn't plan administrators make these kind of factual determinations all the time? I think a quadro is something very different. ERISA specifically talks about quadro and sets out the requirements of the quadro, and as Ms. Hopkins said, actually quadros are qualified before they even get signed by the court. So there's not this general...
No, I understand that, but they still have to... We get this picture painted that it's go to one place and look at one blank, and that's the end of the inquiry, and plan administrators do a whole lot more than that.
They do, but at the same time, what I think this court in Barnett and not the Supreme Court in Eaglehoff has said is the idea of uniformity...
No, I understand, yeah.
Is that plan administrators shouldn't make fact findings such as what we're struggling with today.
But what we have, as I understand Justice Enix's question is, you're talking about quadros, we're talking about before the change in the law that provided for quadros.
So
the question, I think, is that had this divorce decree been given to the plan administrator with her giving up her interest, could the plan administrator have looked at it and given it legal significance?
The plan administrator would have given it legal significance, okay. And I believe the legal significance would have been is that Ms. Keene gave up her community property rights as part of the division of the community estate. Mr. Weaver retained his right to designate, which even during the period of the coverture in community, he had that right under the plan. She had community interest in the retirement benefit, but he also had the right to designate, which he designated prior to divorce, and he had the right afterwards.
That it's go to one place and look at one blank, and that's the end of the inquiry, and plan administrators do a whole lot more than that.
They do, but at the same time, what I think this court in Barnett and not the Supreme Court in Eaglehoff has said is the idea of uniformity.
No, I understand, yeah.
Is that plan administrators shouldn't make fact findings such as what we're struggling with today.
But what we have, as I understand Justice Enix's question is, you're talking about quadros, we're talking about before the change in the law that provided for quadros. So the question, I think, is that had this divorce decree been given to the plan administrator with her giving up her interest, could the plan administrator have looked at it and given it legal significance?
The plan administrator would have given it legal significance, okay. And I believe the legal significance would have been is that Ms. Keene gave up her community property rights as part of the division of the community estate. Mr. Weaver retained his right to designate, which even during the period of the coverture in community, he had that right under the plan. She had community interest in the retirement benefits, but he also had the right to designate, which he designated prior to divorce, and he had the right afterwards, and which he for 13 years. I personally think
he did not redesignate her after the divorce.
He did not redesignate
her. His designation predates the divorce.
That's correct. Okay. But he also received, as Mr. Bresnahan mentioned, he received every year from the plan administrator, you know, notice of the plan, forms, the necessary forms to change the beneficiary if he wanted to change the beneficiary.
Did those forms have her listed as beneficiary?
I believe the form is a blank form that says if you want to change, here's the change.
But was there continuing notice annually of who he had designated as beneficiary?
No. But I'm going to say that the record is clear that he knew who was there. And to say, you know, one of the problems I think we have here is, and Justice Hankinson, you wanted to focus on Ms. Wheat, on Ms. King. What if the rule applies in this case, what you're going to force plan administrators to do is not only look at what Ms. King did, but what Mr. Weaver did, and whether did Mr. Weaver waive the waiver, if there was a waiver in the first place. Did the divorce decree under Texas law divest her and constitute a waiver? I think one of the things here and what y'all admonished us not to do in Barnett is that if you have to look to Texas law for the source of the law, and in this case I would argue that in order to determine whether that divorce decree constitutes a waiver, you have to look at what Texas law, how it construes that divorce decree as to whether it's a waiver or whether it's merely an adjudication of the rights of the community.
How do you explain the Supreme Court's denial of cert in Manning that was pretty adamant about the fact that a beneficiary could waive their interest in the proceeds and that was not a conflict with ERISA. And how do you square that? The Fifth Circuit seems very strong about the fact they went after a trial judge who didn't pay attention to them, and, you know, in their cases. How do you square that?
I think there's two ways of squaring it. The first way is the conceptual way, and that is a denial of certiorari is not precedent and is not a determination of the substance of the case. For whatever reason, they chose not to accept certiorari in the Manning case.
But there's a split in the circuits on that point that Manning was arguing about, wasn't there? Between the Sixth Circuit and the Fifth?
Yes, there was a split in the circuit, but the United States Supreme Court, as does this court, can decide, even when there's a established, recognized split in the circuits, whether they want to take it up in that case or not. I believe that Mr. Bresnahan correctly, if we're going to surmise what the Supreme Court said, is that the result in Manning was correct. In that case, there was no waiver. They agreed with the result. They don't believe that the Manning case was the proper vehicle to resolve the dispute. And I think that you can't read anything more than the denial of certiorari than the fact that they denied cert.
Which means we have an open question.
We have an open question as to whether on the Supreme Court, and I think as this court said in
Barnett. Right, I'm just saying that the issue that's presented in this case is an open question.
But didn't the U.S. Supreme deny cert in another case out of the Fifth Circuit that was decided exactly on that point? I don't remember which one it was.
I don't recall that.
Or Brandon, one of the two, not fairly recent opinions, where the Fifth Circuit established the proposition that you can have this waiver. Maybe I'm remembering the wrong case, but it seemed to me they denied cert in another case where that was squarely the decision.
Again, I don't believe that all it says is that they decided not to resolve that conflict. I believe, as Mr. Bresnahan and Ms. Hopkins said, conceptually, this court and the Supreme Court has already set up a matrix which requires that you can't establish this federal law of waiver. And that, but as to the, is there a split of the circuits? Yes, there is.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
That concludes the argument in the first clause. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.